My name is Jana, as he said, and it's such a pleasure to be with you all. It's hard to follow R.C. Sproul, to be honest, but I'm happy to be here. The promo or the trailer, are we going to do that? I host a podcast where former atheists and skeptics, I interview them about their story, and they give advice at the end to skeptics who are looking to take a step forward towards God. And they give advice to Christians on how they can better engage with skeptics. And this is just a taste of what that...
My own father was in prison for most of my life, from when I was about 5 till high school years. A lot of my situation that came down with my dad and what had gone on there and many circumstances in my life that I can say were not too wonderful of a childhood is part of the reason as well why I was such an atheist.
And I was just like born into a world where anything that you try to interpret beyond what you can see and touch is a fantasy.
I was ambivalent about any higher power, if you will, and really turned to myself. So I guess you could say I was my own God. I was on the throne. It was me who I turned to, and it seemed like I was the only one that I could depend on.
How could there be a God when all of these horrible things have happened to me, and these things continue to happen to everyone else? The Christian cancer patient still dies. The Muslim wife gets in a car accident. The Jew gets hit by a car walking across the street, right? These horrible things happen to people. Why would God allow these things to happen? But you just realize that's not the reason for me not to believe in God. That is the reason for me to believe in God. The fact that these horrible things happen to me and that I screwed up a lot of things in my life, that is all the reason for me to say, okay, now I understand the truth. And instead of saying, no, I want an easy, normal life, I say, I want a difficult life full of suffering that you are using as a test for my character and my will, God, that I can be someone to do this for you. Because you are what truly matters.
So I started opening myself up to interpreting the world as maybe God is acting in my life. And as soon as I started doing that, like dominoes, so many things started falling into place in terms of doors opening, like towards my calling. And it's wild because I never, ever, ever in a million years would have expected that I am in relationship and I can lean into and communicate with and grow through and be challenged by God.
Yes, the world is broken. Yes, I've heard this concept of depravity. Yes, there's sin all over the place. But what would the world be like without Jesus? And so basically wept that whole night in the hotel room, kind of on my back and on my stomach on the floor and saying, Lord, I can't believe what a rebel I've been. I've had this all wrong. And yeah, came to Christ that night. Mm.
It's hard for me not to get emotional every time I see that. It's pretty crazy. I know these stories. I've seen that. But there's something about the work of God in the most unexpected people. You know, it brings hope. And you know, I know that God is at work in the lives of so many people. So many people you think are so far from God. And you don't expect them to come because they're showing no signs. These three people were strong atheists, but then now they're passionate followers of Christ. And they're just, it's just such a privilege to bring these stories forward. But what I want to talk about today is a little bit different than what I talked about last time in terms of what would allow someone to become open. We're going to touch on that, but today we're going to really talk about those who are still pretty steeped in their skepticism. There doesn't seem to be kind of a way forward. We all know skeptics. You know, he mentioned that many of you are lovingly related to people who are skeptics. And that's heartbreaking. And I want to say that we all are skeptical these days of certain things. We're living in a skeptical world. Skepticism is definitely on the rise. It's hard to know what's true, much less what's real. There's so much disinformation. And in some ways, doubt is growing, culturally speaking, doubt is growing in God, and it makes it more challenging to figure out what, again, especially with regard to God, what's real and what's true. But in some ways, the shifting sands of culture are actually pointing towards a belief in something that's so much more foundational, and that is in the person of God. We live in a culture that's skeptical of Christianity, and sometimes the question before us as Christians is, how can we best engage with those who are skeptical? I've spent the last 10 years listening to and learning from the stories of over 100 former atheists and skeptics, and at the end of every interview where I listen to their story, I always ask them, how can we as Christians best engage with those who don't believe? After all, they've been on the inside. They know what it's like to be a skeptic or an atheist. They know what it's like to engage with Christians. They know what worked and what didn't. And so today, I'm just going to look and see and help you understand perhaps how we can better engage. Now, everyone who is pushing back against God or who is skeptical of belief, they have their own reasons. But we're also in a context that also pushes against disbelief. We're dealing with a larger cultural dismissal of faith and a loss of plausibility of belief. Sometimes in the culture, if things don't seem good or seem true or seem attractive, they're just not worth believing. And belief can be dismissed out of hand just because of the water we're swimming in. There's no good reason to engage with the issue of God if everyone around us seems to think that it's not worth even considering. And that's the world that we're living in today, but the times are actually changing. I'm getting a little bit of feedback, sir. Whereas the questions used to be more intellectual, especially during the time of the New Atheists, the questions were very robustly intellectual. You know, does God exist? How do we know? Is Christianity true? And Christianity was seen as a belief system that was not intellectually viable. So we spent a lot of time considering and contending for the truth of Christianity. And there are still some robust arguments that are taking place and should be, because whether or not Christianity is true is still very relevant and to the issue at hand, because most of the skeptics that I talk to won't believe unless they believe it's true. But the questions, culturally speaking, are changing. We're moving from does God exist and those more intellectual questions to more does God matter? Does God make a difference in my life? Because of the movement from a cultural kind of Christianity, we're really stepping back from that, from those shared values, more towards an environment and a culture apart from God and apart from Christianity. I think many people are trying to find their own way in their own lives, and they're finding it a little bit more difficult than they thought that they would. And so when you're left to yourself to create your own meaning, to create your, you know, to ground your own value, to determine your own purpose in your own way, apart from these external, more foundational aspects of God and faith and Christianity, we're finding in culture today, there's a lot, I'm sure you've heard of it, a crisis of meaninglessness. There's a rise in drug addiction and abuse and misuse. There's suicide and just hopelessness. There's a real lostness. I'm sure you can feel it in the cultural current. It's really in our face. But sometimes people think they know what they're rejecting when they reject belief in God and belief in Christianity, but oftentimes they don't actually know what they're embracing until they've lived it for a while. And we're seeing kind of this restlessness, this lostness, these questions arising, culturally speaking, both from the intellectual elites, like how can we sustain a Western civilization when we lose its roots, but also interpersonally, that we're finding that there are more and more people who are really searching for something more. And again, the question is, these big questions, we're looking for big answers to these big questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What satisfies my deepest longings? in this very individualized culture that's based on feeling and it's based on desire and emotion, you know, we're kind of left to ourselves. And it's, again, not an easy place to be. And so we're finding a lot of people who are searching. The tide, it's interesting because during the New Atheist period, when religion was really pushed back, and you know, again, it was intellectual and it was unreasonable to believe and all these poisonous things about Christianity. But now that we've lived without God, you know, we've moved towards a more secular place, culturally speaking, even those in the public elite, intellectual elite, are finding that, you know, we're looking at the vacuum that's created and the chaos that's been produced, culturally speaking, loss of morality, you know, who says what's right and wrong? Who says, you know, we're seeing all kinds of things culturally now, but who's to determine, you know, what grounding do we have to say, well, you know, this is what we should be doing or this is what we shouldn't be doing, civilly, much less in our own lives? How do we ground dignity and values and morals? And so people from the top all the way to the bottom are sensing this kind of disequilibrium, and they're looking for a foundation. Stephanie, you'll recognize her from the trailer. Remember, she said that she couldn't believe in anything unless she could touch or you know, that she could sense it kind of from a scientific, intellectual, rational point of view. But listen to the struggle that she has underneath.
When I was quite young, I developed an individualistic attitude, and I was not super popular in school, and I realized quite early on that I might not be able to get other kids to like me, but I could feel smarter than them. And so I ended up developing this association of the intellect with secularism, with science as something that's not religious, which I don't see anymore, you know. But back then I developed very early on, I latched onto something that I now understand and have studied the history of at length, which is pride, atheist pride, as a way to defend yourself against the emptiness that's there, right? And so I very early on became like the intellectual kid questioning all the sheep following the herd, and I'm smarter and better and I can make it on my own and I don't need any of you and I don't need your comfort and I don't need your gods. And I carried that attitude with me through my undergraduate degree. But then, you know, I wanted to be talking about meaning. Like, I was still really, really, really hungry for meaning, and I couldn't find anywhere to talk about it. And I thought, oh, the religious people are talking about it, but I've been considering them dumb my whole life. So like, I have to, well, I love open-mindedness, and it's wrong of me to be closed-minded about this. And that was, those were the two pieces that sort of helped push me out of that. Plus, I was waking up to the, how empty and alienating my super individualistic attitude was. Like, I was deeply lonely, deeply lonely.
That's probably not unusual these days. You know, on the surface, having good reasons or stated reasons for disbelief, but yet underneath something going on. In my research, where I looked at 50 former atheists, I looked at their stories, why they rejected God, how they became open and moved towards belief. I asked them in survey how they felt about their atheism. And 2/3 said they would never change. You know, that's a pretty strong resistance to belief. But over half of them said they were dissatisfied within their atheism. I think Stephanie gave a good picture of that. People can be dissatisfied for different reasons, but sometimes people who seem resolute aren't as steady underneath the tip of the iceberg. I just want you to keep that in mind. Even though someone has the appearance of, and a strong appearance of disbelief, that doesn't mean that there's something turbulent going underneath the surface. I mean, the good news about this is that 100% of them actually became passionate followers of Christ. So again, another hopeful figure. And just in terms of how we look at how I saw their journeying, when, you know, the kind of questions and the kind of things that they were dealing with, in their skeptical phase, you know, they would say, God doesn't exist and God doesn't matter. I'm fine on my own. Thank you very much. Last time we talked a little bit about the catalyst. The big question that would make someone turn from a closed to an open posturing towards God was this question, predominantly so. 20% were more intellectual, but 80%, it was more this question, does God really matter? Does he make a difference in my life? And that's significant, because oftentimes when they're coming out with a rational reason for refusing God, the reason for openness really may not have anything to do with some kind of abstract intellectual argument at all. Once they began to quest and once they had the will, the openness to quest, then they were willing to see not only does God not matter to my life, but is it true and real? Like I said before, they wouldn't believe unless it were true. So that component is very important. But that wasn't the first thing that helped them turn. And at the end, you know, they came to a very fully orbed belief that God matters to all of life. He informs all of reality, and he informs all of my life. But there's a journeying, and I think we need to kind of pay attention to the very human nature and the very human approach that these former atheists are going to offer to you in terms of how to approach someone who is skeptical. Now, Blaise Pascal said a long time ago that people almost invariably arrive at their beliefs not on the basis of proof, but on the basis of what they find attractive. And that's what we're talking about here. What would turn someone to say that Christianity is good? I want to reconsider. I want to know more. How do we make belief in God attractive? That's the question for us. If attractiveness draws someone to become open to consider God in a serious way, how do we make belief in God attractive? Well, the good news is my research, it was nearly the same as Joel Furches in the fact that God uses us, Christians, to engage or to intersect the lives of those who don't believe to make a big difference. He said in his research, after looking at 32 atheist stories, by far the most significant finding is the influence of a strong Christian friend. A whopping 72% of these biographies included a positive encounter with a Christian or Christians as the major turning point in a person's opinion of Christianity. In my research, it was 82%. There was some kind of positive touch point to Christianity against the negative stereotypes, against all of the bad press, the negative feelings and false beliefs about Christianity, that there was something that a Christian helped, you know, used by the Lord to help change someone's posturing towards Christianity. So the advice that I'm going to give to you now comes straight from all of these former atheists and skeptics in terms of how we should engage as Christians with those who don't believe. Basic rules: don't presume. Realize everyone is different. There, again, is a picture of Christians and Christianity that everyone has in their mind. And we know, just knowing each other, that we're all very different. And we may be different from some other Christians that we know who look at life and think of theology or whatever in a very different way. People call themselves Christian all the time, but what does that really mean? You can't presume. Same thing for those who are skeptical. Just because someone wears the label of skeptic or atheist or even agnostic or that they're just apathetic, whatever, we can presume we know who they are and what they believe, but that's a very dangerous place to stand. Oftentimes, it is the lack of taking time to really understand the other that is the biggest hurdle to even moving forward relationally, much less spiritually, with someone. We need to stop and not presume who the other is without taking time to listen, ask good questions, create openness relationally again, relationship is very important, the respect of the other, understanding and valuing the other, engage them where they are, not where they aren't. I mean, how do you think someone would feel if, say, for example, they had a traumatic event, they lost, say, someone in their life, and it was a devastating event, and then we came at them with kind of some intellectual argument for God, and their pain is really in a different place. It's not going to hit them at all. So we need to make sure that we take time to engage them where they are, to actually, first of all, be willing to engage. I will say, oftentimes, it's an us-them kind of thing, and they're over there, and we're over here. And we have a tendency, I mean, we see this in politics, we see this all the time, where we're making judgments of the other, and like Christians are straw man as being these horrible people, but yet, and we can have the tendency or the temptation to do the same. The important thing is to engage and to actually intersect and break down those barriers. So be willing to engage. Let's listen to what Peter has to say about the dangers of not presuming.
And so there has to be a real willingness to ask questions and expose ourselves to questions being asked of us. I think that's very important. And I think when it comes to communicating Christ and engaging with people, again, I think it's the same stuff about you need to ask them questions. You need to find out where are they starting from. You know, don't rush to assume that you know the person that you're talking to or what their issues are or their questions are or even what the emotional baggage is. You need to take the time to get to know them and find out. Get to know. I mean, why should we expect them to want to get to know us or get to know Christ if we're not willing to get to know them? We have to show that we're willing to engage. So just take that time to understand where the other person's coming from and think, how do I communicate in light of what's going on with them?
Hmm. It's very other-centered thinking, right? It's not coming with an agenda. It's coming to find out. It's coming to discover. It's coming to, in a non-defensive posture, it's coming to engage, to sincerely care about what they're thinking. Will Witt, you probably recognize him in terms of Man on the Street. He's very often talking with people with a different point of view. But listen to his posturing as someone who's approaching someone who has a different perspective.
You don't even have to necessarily go and talk to people about your faith. I think what I found very useful is to talk to people about their faith in atheism. You know, why do they believe that? What brought you to that point? And you can talk to people and just find out why they believe what they believe. You don't need to start out the conversation saying, here's what happened with Jesus, and here's why he died, and here's why you should believe it. It is you going and talking to them all about what they believe to fully understand this person, to understand why they think the way that they do. For the most part, there are, of course, many of brilliantly intelligent atheists who probably have a plethora, a myriad of reasons of why they believe what they believe. And maybe those people, you can't change their mind. But many people, it is for a lot of psychological reasons that people are atheists. It is for lots of different things. So I think it's very important for you to understand where the person is coming from and try and gather their entire worldview before you start talking to them about, here's what the truth is. Do that first so that you can establish that rapport with the person. And then I think you can really start making some good headway.
Again, if you remember in his story, he grew up with a father who was in prison, an absent dad. And so, you know, his story would, you know, there are a lot of, you know, he talks about people believe for psychological reasons. There's some emotional baggage. We need to appreciate people in their wholeness, not just with an argument or things that at the intellectual and rational level. We need to value their story. Nobody holds beliefs in a vacuum. Their convictions are wrapped in a story of how they got there and why they believe what they believe. So the easiest thing is just to sit down, and you don't have to know everything, you know, about the Christian worldview and everything. You just sit down and engage. Tell me about you. Tell me about your story. You know, let me listen. Let me hear, listen towards understanding. Now, when you're listening, there are different reasons why people might push back. In my study, people don't believe it. They don't think it's true, and there's some legitimacy to that. People have sincerely skeptical beliefs with regarding Christianity. Some just think that it's just not good. They don't want to be a part of it. They don't want to be associated with it. You know, all you have to do is put your finger out and poll in culture in terms of, you know, how do people perceive, especially conservative Christians. You get a whole list, and that is not considered good or attractive. Who wants to be called hypocritical, or who wants to be called intolerant or hate-filled or bigoted or whatever the word is? So some people just don't see it as good, don't see religion as good, don't see Christianity as good, may have had some bad experience with it. And some people just don't see it as relevant. You know, they may not have grown up with it at all. It has nothing to do with my life. I have, you know, no need for it. I'm not weak. I don't need that crutch. I don't see where I need any kind of moral authority in my life. It just has nothing to say to me. And then, of course, there are those who don't see or think that it's real. In any way, they may have had an experience like Will, where there was an absent father, a father in prison, a bad circumstance, where an unanswered prayer. Why didn't God show up? How could God? Or why is the world the way that, you know, so many different things. It's more experiential. So when somebody doesn't believe in God, we need to be listening to all and thinking about, you know, who they are and why they're pushing back. And then, you know, we as Christians need to counter the narrative in a sense of breaking down the negative stereotypes and false beliefs and building up plausibility and openness towards God. Again, this is people might refer to this as pre-evangelism or whatever, but there have to be steps towards the gospel that make the gospel desirable and plausible. You know, what about for those who just say, I don't want it? You know, it's very ugly. Being a Christian is very ugly. I don't want it. It's not good. How do we change that again? Some of that is just showing them a different picture, a different way, showing them, giving them visibly a different representation of who they think Christians are that is disarming. You know, we need to be in their lives. We need to be in their lives relationally, to show them a better story than what they've seen, embodying Christ in a deep and very present and powerful way, in a way that perhaps they haven't experienced it or seen a Christ-like life before. We don't want to be present and then be, you know, the Christian that they expect. We want to be present and be that Christ-centered follower. Mike Bird he now holds his PhD in theology, but back in Australia, back in the day, he's a very brilliant man, but I want you to listen to his first piece of advice to Christians. And I think this comes on the back of the fact that he was in the army and watching men kind of, you know, treat women however they wanted. He didn't think it was right, but yet there was one guy, a buddy in the army, that showed him a different way to live and a different way to treat people. And so listen to his first piece of advice.
I think the number one thing I would say is, if you're going to make a difference, you need to be different. And you can't simply imitate the culture or the worst of the culture around you. If you are different in your disposition, your attitude, your joy, the things that you run from and the things that you run to, if you can embody the story of Jesus Christ in your own relationships, people around you will notice. And they may not tell you they notice, but they will notice. The authentic living out of Christian faith is one of the best apologetic strategies that you can provide. You may not be a world-class debater like a William Lane Craig. You may not be a biblical scholar. You may not have the answer to everyone's question. But if you can show that, you know, Jesus really does make a difference in your life and in how you treat other people, I think that will speak volumes to the people around, and even those who may not believe with you will at least respect you for your conviction and your Christ-likeness.
And John is someone who really takes intentionality towards engaging with those who don't believe in order to show them Christ and to show them a different, better story.
But those little things that I saw were, okay, there's something different about this guy, but I'm still relatable and I'm still fun and I'm still cool enough to hang out with, that they don't really care if I'm not getting drunk with them. You know, and sometimes Christians get in, here's the thrust of my answer, Gina. Christians get in the bubble so much, they don't know how to hang out with sinners anymore. And that is a sad thing, because our Lord walked with people to the point where they thought he was one of them, even though he never partook in the same life that they did. And they accused him of all kinds of horrible stuff. I don't want to be accused of false accusations or anything, but if people see me hanging out on my porch over here with my, these neighbors that drink a lot, I'm okay if they question me where I'm at. But those neighbors, when they went out of town just a couple days ago, the guy's a blue collar worker and he's like talking about having to go shopping. I was like, man, you're the same size as me. Look, we're looking at each other in the eyes. Come on. And I loaned him one of my suits for this wedding he's got to go to. And then as he's leaving town, he's like, hey, can you make sure everything's fine at my house? Can you keep an eye on it? Yes. You know, those kinds of things just continue to build those bonds and those relationships. And I'm about to move. So I'm in an apartment right now, but I'm about to move. And they're like, man, we were going to miss you so much. And I was like, man, I'm literally like a 2 miles up here, up the road. Well, we have got to stay in touch. I'm going to stay in touch with these guys. Not because I like to hang out with them and drink, and they watch a lot of basketball and football, and I don't watch any sports. But they know, hey, we can talk about anything, and we can hang out and do, you know, and you can. I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to be angry towards you. But when the bottom falls out of their life, you know, I expect that they're going to talk to me. And I found that to be true over these 21 years of following Christ, that if I can just be a constant witness that's not judgmental, that's not angry, and not living like the world, that sooner or later when the bottom falls out, they're going to pick up the phone and call me.
Yeah, I think that's pretty powerful. He's generous. He's kind. He's, you know, I imagine if you talked with his neighbors, would they say, are Christians, you know, is John good? You know, and of course, theologically, we're none of us good, right? But would they see him as a good guy? Would they think of Christianity and God and John and say, oh, those are horrible people? No, it's hard to think poorly of someone who is giving you the clothes off his back, literally. When you're being loved on, it's hard to think poorly of. And he's right. The relational investment over a period of time, from last time we talked about disruptions, there oftentimes is a time in someone's life where they're willing to consider God, where they may not have, you know, for years. But then there comes a time, and who are they going to call? They're going to call John, because they know that he's there, that he cares, that he values. He's all those things that we're meant to be as, you know, Christ followers. Well, what about those who, again, they just say, it's not, you know, I don't need it, it's not relevant to me, it's moralistic, intolerant, weak, outdated. Again, I'm sure those are the guys who are in John's life right now. But he is present in their lives. He's showing them that belief in God can make a difference now. And this way, it's especially considering what I was speaking about earlier, does God matter? You know, when the time comes where someone is actually willing and to be open, what are they seeing? What are they seeing along the way in your life? Are they seeing that, you know, it's full of meaning? You're contented. You're not fearful. You're faithful. You're peaceful despite the circumstances. You're finding, you know, great joy despite hardships. I mean, what kind of person does that, especially in the world? Let's listen to Patrick as he, again, a very heady guy, but listen to his first piece of advice.
There are a lot of skeptics out there who do have an issue with the will toward religion. It is not just an intellectual problem. There are going to be people who have had very bad experiences or for other reasons are committed against religion. It often tends to be political, if we're being honest. So what do you do? You have to be the example. and this is where I talked about my one friend before, I think influenced me more than I realized at the time. She was not a philosopher, didn't think about these questions as philosophers do. But there was a radiance about her and the life she lived and her pursuit of just wanting to be a saint that I found really kind of quite admirable and beautiful. So I think that's the other side of it, is living that Christian life, understanding that for a lot of people, it's not just about giving arguments. But I've realized that the usefulness is actually somewhat limited of that. It's the life you live overall, how you interact with other people, how you treat other people, and building those relationships and friendships first that makes it so you can actually, that gives you the fertile ground for conversations that then can be productive.
Again, especially living a life that is demonstrably Christ-like, where you're embodying Christ, where the Spirit of God is living in you and is present. Alistair McGrath, if any of you know him, he's got 3 PhDs from Oxford. But he is understanding the culture. He's understanding that there are stories that we live by. The God story is the best story. It gives the best answers to the big questions of life, of meaning, of purpose, of value. It's the only one, actually, that gives a real and substantive answer. He could, in many ways, come at a skeptic with all kinds of intellectual fodder and tell them why they're wrong. But it's really interesting because him of all people could fly that flag, but he is all about humility and exploring together. And let's look at, does your life, is it giving you all that you want it to give? Let's listen.
Well, I think I'm going to say 2 things. One is that there's a danger that we'll come across as being critical. In effect, we're saying, we are right, you're wrong. I think it's very helpful to use the language of exploring. In other words, I'm going to share with you what my faith is all about, and I'm just going to tell you how I find the difference it makes to me. And, you know, at this stage, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying, let's explore it a bit. I'm going to tell you the difference it makes to me, and I'm going to invite you to think about, as I talk to you, whether you feel you can say the same about your naturalism, your atheism, whether it, in effect, gives you the same basis for living, reason for hoping that I'm describing to you now. And that's a very important point. But the testimony you're giving is not simply, I think this is right, but I think this is real. In other words, it makes a difference to me. It gives me a reason to hope. It gives me a reason to live. It helps me to position myself. And one of the points I find in talking to many atheists is they feel, well, actually, I may be right, but it doesn't do any of these things for me. And therefore, in effect, introducing these new set of questions, is this real? Does it give me a reason to hope? Does it, in effect, give me a new sense of purpose and direction? These can be ways that may not, in effect, change somebody's life, but it might be questions that open up recesses in their minds where transition can take place. So don't be discouraged if you get nowhere. Just feel you've planted some seeds, and in the Lord's good time, these will grow if they're meant to.
Interestingly, the young intellectual woman that we played at the beginning, Stephanie, he was her supervisor at her PhD program in Oxford. He helped her see that Christianity was not only intellectually robust, but provided everything she was looking for, all that meaninglessness, you know, that she was, that emptiness. She found all that through Christ by following his, you know, his lead, essentially. Well, what about those who are really rejecting because they've had some kind of personal pain, absence, loneliness, confusion, they don't see or feel God in their world? It's probably not surprising that we need to be present in their lives during times of need, that they can palpably feel what love is. I have so many stories like that where even the crustiest people were transformed through love. Again, these are highly intellectual people, but listen to the first thing they talk about. This is Fez Rana. He's a PhD scientist.
the first thing that we have to do is recognize that regardless of a person's worldview and whether their worldview is something that we would share, we have to recognize that they are image bearers and that they are have infinite worth and value, that they are sacred, and that our greatest obligation towards those people is to love them, right? And if we have to, anything we do as we engage non-believers has to be ultimately shaped by our genuine love for them. If we can't say that we genuinely love that person, we probably shouldn't try to present the gospel to them. But when people know that you genuinely love them and that you accept them regardless of their perspective, that goes a long ways, I think, towards really building genuine bridges with other people. But I think you can love people, and through that love, they'll experience the love of Christ, and that will, I think, open them up to evidences and soften their heart towards evidences if that's what they need.
Same thing with Dr. Craig Keener.
You know, it helps, I think, to be able to answer people's questions. But you're not just dealing with an argument. You're dealing with a person. And that person needs to be shown the love of God. It makes love a whole lot more believable if people can actually see it embodied in a world where sometimes love is hard to find, or where people have experienced deep brokenness, or sometimes even, I think sometimes my feelings were frozen. I didn't want to deal with the feeling level, but I mean, we're whole people, and that's part of who we are too. So be patient.
And again, the one who contends for, you know, the case for Christ, listen to the way that he draws out what is really going on with a person to see where he should love them.
I think to respect people, to love them as Jesus loved them, as people made in God's image, to try to get away from this us versus them mentality and say we're all in this together. We're all in this world together. And to care enough to sit down and have a conversation. Here's the question I like to ask, and I've changed through the years as culture has changed. But the question I always used to ask someone I would engage in, it says, let me just ask you one thing. If you could ask God any one question, and you knew he'd give you an answer right now, what would you ask him? And I used to ask that of skeptics, and because it helped crystallize what their objections are. But nowadays, I don't stop there. So I'll ask that question, and 8 times out of 10, the answer is something along the lines of, why does a loving God allow suffering? I mean, that's a very, very common response. And instead of then giving a 5-point sermon on why God allows suffering, I ask a follow-up question. And the follow-up question is, of all the possible questions in the universe, why did you choose that one? And now it gets down to the heart. Because they'll say, because my wife was just diagnosed with cancer, and I want to know if there's a God, why would he allow that? Or we lost a child in childbirth 5 years ago. Where was God when that happened? Now we're getting to the real issues. So I want to get, yes, apologetics, evidence for the faith is important, but the heart is important. And that's ultimately where decisions, whether we want to admit it or not, are generally made. And so I want to diagnose what is the impediment, what is the obstacle. And a lot of times, what that person needs is not, as I said, a 5-point sermon on why God allows suffering. He needs someone who's going to be Jesus to them, who's going to put their arm around their shoulder and is going to sit with them and is going to cry with them and is going to commiserate with them and empathize with them. And sometimes, you know, it's not the words, it's the actions, it's the empathy, it's the love of Christ that they feel, that we care enough about them to resonate with whatever it is that's the impediment between them and God. Sometimes it is just an intellectual issue. But many times there's emotional issues behind it, like there was with me, with my father. And so we need to delve into those as well.
Again, they were whole people. They're not just, oftentimes we just tend to not think deeply enough about the personal hurt and pain that in the person across from us. But again, I hope you heard how he was other-centered, very other-centered. It wasn't about an agenda or coming with information. It was really looking at the other. Now, of course, like you said, sometimes there are very genuine intellectual issues that need to be addressed, because there's a strong perception that Christians are uneducated, ignorant, defensive, fearful. And not approachable sometimes with regard to things, with regard to the truth of Christianity, and they just don't think it's true, not even worth, considering. But we need to, again, counter that narrative. We need to be prepared, and we need to introduce them to a better worldview story. I'm here to tell you after, just like all of these people, when you look at the Christian worldview, it does give the best answers to the big questions of Christ, of life, all of reality, and our own life. And so when you learn that in a substantive way, then you can approach others with a lot less defensiveness, more compassion, more confidence, kind of a quiet confidence. But I think... No, this is the episode that just came out, and I think what he's saying here is very, very pivotal, because he was a Christian, but he deconstructed because he was doubting whether or not Christianity was true, and so he wanted to go on a journey to figure out whether or not, again, what he was believing was worth believing. But listen very closely, because this is a common issue among those who are deconstructing, is that sometimes their questions aren't taken seriously enough.
That is exactly how it feels for an intellectual to come into a church and ask you, where did Cain get his wife? And you to say, you just need to have more faith. Mm. Because the question for them is personal. The question itself is personal. And so just sitting there and listening to their question and saying, that's a really good question, let me help you find an answer for that, is caring for them. But to give them dismissive answers, you are indirectly telling them, I don't care what you think. I don't think your question is important, and I don't care that you think about it. That's what you're telling them. You're being uncompassionate. So for those that are honest skeptics, be patient with them, listen for their questions, seek to answer them.
Again, he does in the interview, it's worth listening, not for self-promotion, just because the content is so good. But he does differentiate between those who are dishonest skeptics, who are just throwing things out and really don't want to know the answer. And we've all kind of felt that tension. But there are those who actually are seeking. They want to know, is this true? Is it worth believing? And it's interesting too, the words that he uses, compassionate, it's caring, to actually come alongside and say, well, maybe I don't know, but let's find this together, or find someone who can help you find the answer, rather than dismissing. Dismissing pushes people away. Defensiveness pushes people away. Again, welcoming, and as Dr. McGrath says, side by side, exploring, let's see what we can find. It creates a completely different posturing towards moving towards truth rather than away from it. Brian is just here emphasizing why that we need to really understand why we believe what we believe.
So, but is there really a more important and fundamental question than, is there a God? I mean, that was the question for me, was, who was Jesus? And I think the answer to that question just has ramifications for every other question in life. So ideally, I want to move the skeptic from a state of complacency to a state of curiosity. And then somehow pointing all of these things to the Jesus story as this curious resolution to all of these big questions. Maybe a worldview of science only, or materialist only, or secular only, just sort of has some serious gaps that maybe you can have them to be, get them to be a little more curious
and that maybe that this Jesus story is actually more credible. I think to the Christian, well, let me just say, a few times a year, I try to ask myself this question: what breaks my heart? And then to lean into that heartbreak, thinking about how I can help or how can I be used by the Holy Spirit. I mean, the polling data seems to suggest that the average Christian in the pews has a rather flimsy understanding of what they believe and why they believe it. And that we've collectively been sort of drifting away from those core Orthodox beliefs, probably swayed by the whims of the culture or the arguments of the new atheists. So it's no wonder that, you know, many people tend to fall away from their faith when they enter the secular university or enter the secular job force, or when they simply just befriend an intelligent skeptic or an atheistic professor. I think there are just far too many Christians out there whose faith is like a house built on sand. And, or maybe to use a better reference would be Jesus's parable of the sower, in which some people hear the word and they believe, but because they have shallow roots, as soon as they're tested, they fall away from their faith. And honestly, that's what really breaks my heart right now. Because it just seems like those who fall away so quickly upon fairly shallow challenges is that they don't know how well Christianity addresses the tough questions. I mean, they've been raised on a diet of milk, but even as adults, they're still drinking milk, and what they need is meat. And Christianity just has this super long and distinguished tradition of pursuing and defending the truth. And it is meat. It's beautiful. It's encouraging. And I just, in my thinking, if they only knew the strength of their foundation in faith, they'd be better equipped to talk to their skeptical friends, to talk to the nuns out there. If more Christians were encouraged by this intellectual history of our faith and the soundness of the arguments and our claims as Christians, then having these discussions with non-believers can just feel so much more natural. It can be less intimidating. We have to do this, of course, with gentleness and respect. But that would be my encouragement to the Christian out there, is get familiar with some of this stuff, because once you're armed with that, you don't have to use it as a weapon. You use it as an encouragement. And that way you can bring up these types of topics with those skeptics out there.
Yeah, I think I'll just, again, double down on what he's saying. I used to be so fearful because I didn't understand why I believed what I believed, and I didn't understand really worldviews outside of Christianity, and it used to be very intimidating, and I was very defensive, and I didn't know how to engage. But once you understand your story better and why it's true, and you understand others' stories better, and you see how he talked about the gaps in their worldviews, and once you understand that other worldviews are filled with major gaps, significant gaps about how to answer questions, due to time, I need to move forward. So it's important to know why we believe, because it changes your whole approach. Chris encourages us, again, not just to have knowledge that we're telling, but again, through strategic question asking, helping others to determine the weaknesses, the gaps in their own worldview.
I think never underestimate the power of a good question. You know, I think the question, why would you say that, is a really powerful apologetic question, because if you ask that question, people will start to question their own assumptions. And usually those assumptions are only one or two or three in line for their argument to fall down. Or certainly their position to fall down, because they realize that, you know, their position is vacuous. There's nothing there. I think it's when you ask a question, it's never about winning the war. You know, especially in the job that I'm doing at the moment, I've met all sorts of Christians now,
It's never even about winning the battle. It's just about giving people the permission to ask that question. And maybe just making them feel a little bit uncomfortable. And I think it's Kugel who refers to it as just putting a stone in someone's shoe.
Greg Kokel, yeah. But again, yeah, it's interesting because oftentimes when you're having conversation with people who are skeptical, they're often really positioning themselves of what's wrong with Christianity and destroying it. I can't believe because of this and this and this and this. But then when you turn and ask them, okay, what do you believe? Then it moves the conversation to a different place where they have to actually substantiate, again, some of the big issues and questions in life and reality. And it's harder for them to do that. It's easier for them to tear down than to substantiate a foundation that is really poorly founded. It's very, very important to be patient, especially with people you love, to not be pushy. I don't know how many times I've heard in these stories, I couldn't have done it if they were pushing me or if they were pressing me. It has to come from the person. You can, as Brian says, you can kind of ask questions to raise curiosity or move the skeptic towards a curious place. But pushing and pressing is probably not the best position to be in. This is Dr. Tim Stratton.
So then I would just say to those who are having conversations with skeptics or non-believers in general, don't wipe the dust off your feet too quickly. I see too many Christians just say, well, I had a conversation with them once and wiping the dust off of my feet and walking away, you know, to quote scripture. I'm aware, just last week was with somebody who led his friend to Christ after 30 years of sharing the gospel and doing apologetics with him. 30 years, this man finally accepted the truth and accepted the evidence, followed the evidence where it was leading, and gave his life to Christ.
And finally, be prayerful, right? This is a work of God in the hearts of men and women. It is a work of God. We are used by him and for his purposes, but we are dependent upon him. You never know. The stories that I've heard, I heard that so-and-so was praying for me. I had no idea that so-and-so had been praying for me. Listen to Vince Vitale, Dr. Vince Vitale again. This is passionate. This is a passionate admonishment for him.
Pray for God's heart for people. I think that is so significant because, you know, at the end of the day, God will use you when your heart breaks for the lost. Pray for that because we all can have that. It's not something we can manifest. It's something God can give as a gift, and I believe will give to those who ask him. God is always doing more than we can see. Nevertheless, and not too long ago, I had an encouragement in this respect with regard to my own story. So I told you that I came to Christ in 122 Jolene Hall. That was my dorm room. That's where I dropped to my knees. A few years ago, I was telling my story somewhere, and afterwards, a woman came to the front, and I could see she was tearing. She was emotional. She was moved. And she said, "Did you say 122 Jolene Hall?" And I said, "Yes, that was my dorm room." And she said, "Well, I'm about 15 years older than you, and I went to Princeton too, and I lived in 121 Jolene Hall next door." And she said, "I spent my 4 years in college praying for the salvation of the guys in 122 Jolene Hall." And she said, "All these years, I felt like God didn't hear that prayer because I never saw that prayer answered. But as you said that from the front, I realized that God not only heard my prayer, but he answered my prayer word for word for the salvation of the guys in 122 Jolene Hall." And so just the graciousness of God that 15 years before I even would have given him a second thought, he had someone literally praying for the floor on which I would drop to my knees and give my life to him. And, you know, I guess if you're from a skeptical persuasion, like I was, you could chalk that up to a very great coincidence. But maybe, you know, and I would invite anyone who's listening to consider the fact that maybe God is pursuing each one of us like that, where even years before we thought to give him the time of the day, he had specific people praying for us, praying for the very locations we would be in, the very times and places in which we ultimately would give our lives to him.
So, yeah, beautiful, isn't it? Beautiful story of patience and prayer. Because you never know when and where someone will turn. And there's always, always hope. In the meantime, Blaise again reminds us to make religion attractive, make it good, make good men wish it were true, and then show that it is. And again, I've seen it over and over, how the Lord uses Christians in the lives of those who are skeptical. I hope this today has been an encouragement to you. If you want to hear more encouraging stories, you might find, you know, if there are people in your life that have a particular issue with God, again, we have almost 100 stories where people of all different kinds of resistance are away from God, come to God, you hear their stories, you start to understand journeys, you start to understand what moves someone to another place. But yeah, take a listen to some of those stories. It's on podcast, it's on YouTube. But anyway, this is just a little summary, and I'll leave it here in case somebody, do we have a 5 minutes to, if anybody has a question that I can address here?
Questions?
Thank you. I really don't have a question, but my own experience I've had talking with people who weren't necessarily proclaimed atheists, but they obviously were not religious at all. And what I found most helpful was to present them with the story of one solitary life that tells the life of Jesus briefly. And then at the end it says all the parliaments that ever met, all the armies that ever marched, all the navies that ever served, all the kings that ever ruled, never had as much influence altogether as that one solitary life of Jesus. And then they become curious about this man. Maybe there's something to it. And then I've had them ask me, could you bring me one of those books that you Christians like? I don't know the name of it, but they'll say. But I found that poem kind of opens the door to curiosity, like one of the speakers said. And I think that's a way to get into it with yeah. people that you already know.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought that up because, you know, ultimately we're to point people to Christ, right? Our lives, our love, everything, we are just reflections of him. But there's so many stories where someone actually became curious about Christ. And so the more that we can invite them to read the Word, to read the stories of Jesus in the Bible, the Gospels, they are completely undone many times by what they find in Scripture if they haven't really read it for the first time, who they see the person of Christ is. There was one guy who said when I read the Bible, he had mentioned he had religious experience, and I'm like, what was that? He said, well, whenever I read Christ and read about him in Scripture, I would shake. I just couldn't believe that there was someone like that who could love me and care for me like that. So, yeah, encourage people to read Scripture. Invite them to church. Sometimes just very small gestures can go a very long way.
How do you deal with LGBTQ folks?
Who's asking the question?
I am.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would bring this up 2 minutes left. That's the question of the day, isn't it? That's the most difficult question of the day, I think. I think there's been a lot of confusion because of the way that love is defined and the question of who is defining it. And also the question of authority and where do you find that? It's very, very difficult. And I've seen the conversation about how we as Christians should engage with those with LGBTQ people. They are people loved. They're made in the image of God. They have issues and struggles just like we all have. I think the posture taken here of inviting, of listening, of loving, but not compromising on truth. There's a beautiful testimony given by Rosaria Butterfield called Secrets of an Unlikely Convert, where she was a university professor. She led the LGBT, well, they didn't have T movement back then, but she led that movement on campus. I mean, she had a long-standing relationship with her lesbian partner. She was really against the Bible. In fact, she wanted to study the Bible to kind of basically tear it down. So she engaged in a conversational relationship with a pastor and his wife, who started inviting her over for dinner, because there's something that happens relationally when you gather around a table. It doesn't feel as defensive, you know. So she started coming weekly to their table. And so it was a long-term investment. It was a genuine and mutual respect. It was a loving of the other and conversations. But for the pastor and his wife, they never compromised on what they believed to be true and the authority of Scripture. And I think that's also very important, because sometimes, although it feels loving to compromise, to make someone feel welcome, and there's actually a very big conversation going on in the Christian community about this. What kind of language should you use? What kind of pronouns should you use in order to not, versus those who are saying we should not live by lies, by affirming a false identity in someone, is actually not a loving thing to do, you know? So I'm more on the camp of really esteeming Scripture and Jesus, and trying my best not to offend someone, but not compromising on truth. I mean, I don't want to affirm something that is a lie, but loving in grace, and again, bringing in and maintaining a relationship as best you can, with mutual respect, but it's certainly not dismissing or tearing down, or, you know, because we're all human and we're all desperately seeking for, you know, what are they looking for? They're searching for an identity, right? A belonging, an acceptance, a community. There's a lot of, some of them have been very abused in their lives, so they're choosing a different way. There's so much brokenness culturally. I think we need to be sensitive to that and come alongside versus putting off. But yet again, not compromising, loving in truth. It's just that beautiful balance of grace and truth, love and truth. Any other thoughts anyone wants to add to that? It's not easy.
Thank you, Janet.
Yes.
But the gospel is offensive.
Yes, the gospel is offensive.
I mean, yeah. Jesus, the mm-hmm. truth.
No, absolutely.
That's what tore me apart.
Yeah.
You know, I had to face the realities. But I had somebody that did care, you know. And like Schaefer says, we fail to engage the mind. But that's back in the 60s, 70s, just believe. But a lot of that's today, you know. But it seems like this friendship evangelism without truth is a very dangerous place to go.
I agree.
You just said that. You explained
agreed.
That.
Agreed. Nobody, I mean, and none of these skeptics believed unless they believed it was true. And so there was very much a due diligence. This is basically getting someone turning towards the posture of openness and willingness, because you know as well as I do, if someone's not willing, I have a chapter in my book called If There's Not a Will, There's Not a Way. Because if someone's not willing to even engage the truth for what it is, they will put it off and make every excuse. So these are just basically door openers to allow, to pave the way like Lee Strobel says, to then engage with the truth of the gospel. Does that make sense? I have an apologetic degree in apologetics, love the truth. And there's no compromise there. It's just getting them to a place of being able to engage in the truth in a meaningful way.
But is it okay to be tough with certain people? You know, these tricksters, you know, they're just trying to be hard guys.
Yeah.
And you could take Schaefer and you could blow him out of the water with their presuppositions of life.
Right. Yeah. I was just having an online, I know we're probably 10:19. I don't want to hold anybody over. I was just having a conversation with a contra theist in the last 2 weeks, and he was all about condescension and tearing down and God, you know, his identity was wrapped up in everything that's wrong with Christians and Christianity. And let me give you the arguments and the evidence. And I was trying to engage in a way that brings them, like Schaefer would do, down to the worldview level. And let's look at, okay, I even said, for the sake of argument, what if I agree to every argument that's dismissing God? Okay, let's look at what you believe. Let's see what you're for and what your foundations are. And he wouldn't go there. He was being, he kept calling, he was the very gas, he was gaslighting me all over the place. You know, you're very evasive and you're this and you're that. Now I'm like, no. Even Graham Oppy, the atheist philosopher, says, you know, let's not kind of nitpick at the level of arguments. Let's get down to the world of ideas and worldview, so that we can, because every worldview has to stand and fall on certain foundations. They have to answer all the big questions of life and reality within whatever their worldview is. And the Christian worldview is the only one that actually provides substance. And so, but someone has to be willing to engage with you rather than just, I'm just tearing you down. I'm just tearing you down. I mean, those, you know, you can play those games all day long and not get anywhere. But it has to be prayerfully and graciously approached. I actually ended the conversation. I said, I don't think we can have a productive or meaningful conversation here. I don't want to keep going. So sometimes you have to understand where the limits are, but continue if you can. This was a stranger to me, and another one very similar. I was like, okay, let's set this back. Tell me why you became an atheist. You know, he was telling me all these different reasons why he couldn't believe. I'm like, well, what do you believe, and how did you become an atheist?
But you don't want to use friendship evangelism. You know, like people say, you're just being friendly to me because you want me to see Jesus.
Well, then good. Praise God. If somebody can see Jesus from your friendship evangelism, then you're taking a step forward. As long as you can take...
I'm willing to be involved and continue on, and I back up. Said I was. I'm proving myself a hypocrite.
Yes and no. I mean, we're not supposed to, you know, what is it?
This is
pearls
a,
to swine.
Yeah, this is a conversation we could go a long time. You know what? Let's think about this. Maybe we'll invite Dr. Harmon back again, and maybe we'll have. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Fantastic presentation. I love the bullet points, and I love the way you presented them. There's a lot of meat and potatoes here, and a lot of energy around this about the how to's and what do you say's and how do you position it, and the relationship is so key to this. But we could go on and on, but I'm cognizant of the time, and we want to thank you. Let's close in prayer if we might. Holy Father, what a wonderful God you are. Thank you, Holy Father. Thank you for today's lesson and reminder of some of the things that are just so reasonable, so rational, and yet we get emotionally caught up. We want to see things happen in our way, in our time. One of the statements was made was in God's good time. We hear you. We believe what you say when you say the promise is for us and our children. So thank you, Lord, as we move from here on to worship and second session. Thank you for... Dr. Harmon's sharing what she has, and we pray that we'll take this forward to serve you well. Amen.